All right, it's Monday, April 19th, and this is the Vegan Rainbow Show once again here on WHRW Binghamton. I'm Bill Houston.
And Mike Hudak.
Mike, why don't you introduce our guest today?
Sure. Scott Silver is co-founder and executive director of Wild Wilderness based in Bend, Oregon. Since 1991, this nonprofit environmental organization has sought to ensure that wilderness areas, roadless areas, and other areas now substantially free of development will continue to provide outstanding opportunities for high-quality, non-motorized recreation. As Wild Wilderness Director, Silver has focused his efforts on educating the American public about changing attitudes in federal lands management philosophy that are leading towards greater commercialization, privatization, and motorization of our nation's public lands. Prior to his current position, Silver was senior scientist or staff scientist with several prominent biotechnology companies and has made significant contributions in the fields of large-scale enzymology and biorational insect control. Silver received his honors degree from the University of Manchester, England in 1975. He joins us today from his home in Bend, Oregon. Scott, are you there?
I am indeed.
Hi. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me on your program this evening.
Well, let's talk about your organization. I believe you started it in the early 1990s, and I'm curious what led you to actually found the organization.
Well, you're right. We did start as a couple of individuals without a name in about 1990, started participating in local Forest Service planning meetings, and the two of us who were the co-founders were backcountry skiers, and we would go to Forest Service meetings where there would be representatives from every kind of user group making their demands for how blank spots on the map could be further improved by developing either snowmobile trails or this or that or the other thing. And we discovered that there was a need for some representation for people like us, backcountry skiers, who needed those blank spots on the map as a place where we would recreate. And we didn't see them as underutilized resources at all. We saw them as important recreational opportunities. That was our early start. And as years went by, we became more formal and represented those interests in our local community.
Did you attempt to work through established organizations before you did that, like perhaps the Sierra Club?
In our local community, there really was no organization wanting to represent the interests of undeveloped recreation. A lot of groups, conservation, environmental, and recreation groups, all had some sort of recreational pursuit that they wanted to advocate for. So there was actually a need and a niche, and we filled it locally. Now, of course, things changed. We've evolved from a local niche group to a pretty well-known national organization, small but well-known. But that was a result of a situation no one could have predicted. It was a result of tripping over something, so to speak.
Well, yeah, I want to talk about that later, and I know what you're referring to, but I did want to talk a little bit more about what you did regionally until this national issue came along in the mid-1990s. So what kinds of projects, then, did you work on in 91, 92, up until 96 or
well,
so?
Well, we had two main thrusts, and we were remarkably successful in both of them. Perhaps it was beginner's luck. The first issue that got us started was in the year 1991. There were two proposals to build hut-to-hut skiing in or around the Three Sisters Wilderness, which is the wilderness area closest to my community of Bend. We had some problems with those proposals, especially the one that would operate in the wilderness. Basically, the outfitters were proposing to build a base camp in what was the destination for most people who tried to ski to the wilderness and enjoy the wilderness. So instead of a person getting to the wilderness and being treated by wilderness, a person would only get to the base camp of a commercial outfitter, and basically depriving all of those non-commercial users from being able to enjoy a wilderness experience. That was issue number one. Issue number two was we were finding that snowmobile use was proliferating at a fantastic rate, and that the opportunities to have a quiet, contemplative, non-motorized recreational experience were quickly evaporating. And we have, since 91 to this day, and probably for as long as I'm going to be alive, we have dealt with the issues of motorized user conflict, and that is an issue that we've had some early success on, but we're fighting it to this day.
Then, as you indicated before, something changed in the mid-90s, and that was the passage of the Recreation Fee Demonstration Program.
Well, it was, in fact, that event, but that's not how it impacted my life. The way it happened was kind of surprising, but the co-founder of Wild Wilderness and I went to the Forest Service to pick up our free volunteer passes for this new recreation fee demonstration program. And just to give you a little hint what this program's about, the way we understood it at that time is it was to provide some supplemental money to provide better maintenance, better cleaning of toilets, better trail maintenance. It sounded all right. It was going to cost $3 a day or $25 a year, and besides, we're giving free passes to volunteers, so it wasn't going to cost us anything. But when we were at the Forest Service office, I happened to pick up a flyer that was being offered at that time. And it was an official Forest Service flyer, and on the bottom of it was something that caught my eye and literally did change my life. It said, the Recreation Fee Demonstration Program is occurring as a challenge cost share partnership with leading recreation interests. And then it went on to explain that this company, the American Recreation Coalition, would work with the industry and with users to explain the program and provide further input to the Forest Service for how best to manage the program. Mm-hmm. Well, I tell you, because of my bias and concern about protecting low-impact, undeveloped recreation, there was something in that passage that attracted my attention, caused me to do some basic research, to learn who these people were, and that event has been what's changed my life.
Well, tell us about the American Recreation Coalition. I think that many people are not aware that it exists.
Well, is easy enough. I went to the web, looked them up. Their member list was provided, and the members have cycled through and changed a little bit, so I'll give you some names that may or may not be there today. There were about 150 companies represented, and they represented the interests of every kind of motorized recreation, commercial developer, everything you can imagine. I'll give you some examples. Back in those days, some of the names that really caught my attention was the American Petroleum Institute, Chevron, Exxon, the Walt Disney Company, the American Motorcyclist Association, International Jet Ski Association, International Snowmobile Manufacturers Association, Campgrounds of America, and on and on and on. I then did a little bit more learning about these folks and found that basically they were hardcore, motorized, wise use, anti-environmental organization. And they had a very specific reason for promoting these fees. The idea was that there was sufficient environmental pressure being applied upon motorized recreation that these motorized recreation groups were afraid that they would not have free rein on America's public lands. And so the concept was, if the forest management, land management, was shifted to a pay-to-play paradigm where the land managers would be largely deprived of congressionally allocated funding and be forced to turn more directly to their customers for sources of revenue, then those customers willing to pay the most would get to play the most. And the logic of this organization, logic that they really made no effort to hide, was that the high-impact users were prepared to pay more because they demanded more, expected more, and were prepared to pay for it. And if paying was a way to guarantee access and to shape public land policy, then that was far preferable than being excluded from the public lands.
And there's a second organization as well that has been pushing this, and that's the Recreation Roundtable. Can you explain what they are and how they're related to the American Recreation Coalition?
The Recreation Roundtable is a group of 25 or so chief executive officers and similarly highly placed executives within America's most powerful recreation companies, recreation and tourism companies. It is in some ways indistinguishable from the American Recreation Coalition. It has the same mailing address, the same phone number, the same fax machine. It has no existence on its own. The American Recreation Coalition lists the Recreation Roundtable as an expense item on their tax form. And this is a nonprofit organization, so their tax form is publicly available, and I have most of them. But what the Recreation Roundtable does do that's different than the American Recreation Coalition is it presents the views of these top executives within the recreation industry and represents itself to the government as if it were a different entity than the American Recreation Coalition. In other words, the American Recreation Coalition gets two votes instead of one.
I see. Well, Scott, what's happened with the recreation fee program over the last few years? How's it been working out for the Forest Service? So what kinds of things have been going on that you particularly see as unfavorable?
Well, let's go back to let your listeners know a little bit more about it. The program was authorized in 1996 as a rider inserted into the appropriations bill in that year. There had been standalone legislation to try to make this program, to authorize this program, but that legislation got no traction at all. It did not pass. It did not submit, just get a hearing. So a friendly congressional literally snuck it into the appropriations bill that year. The program was only to last for 3 years as a demonstration program, and it was to have expired in 1999. The purpose of the demonstration was to remove the prohibition that had existed since 1965 upon charging for most things on federally managed public lands. Prior to the fee demonstration program, the only fees that could legally be charged were national park entrance fees, fees for developed campgrounds, for specific types of mechanical boat launching facilities, and for 21 visitor centers that were enumerated within the legislation. So what the fee demonstration program did is said, let's forget about those prohibitions and let's open everything up to fees and see what works and see what doesn't work. See what methods of collection work, what people are willing to pay for, what they'll object to. So it was a demonstration program to prove to Congress what worked and what didn't. 1999 came and went and the program had not proved itself. In fact, the program had proved to be exceedingly controversial. So the same person who had inserted the rider language in the original 1996 appropriations bill did the same thing and has done so repeatedly, extending the program now a total of four times so that it's currently approved through the end of 2005. You've asked what worked and what didn't work. What have we seen? Well, what we've seen is the national parks have been reasonably successful in generating revenues from this program. And what the fee demonstration program did for the parks was somewhat different than for other land management agencies. For the parks, people were used to paying because fees were previously allowed. But with the parks, the fee demonstration program allowed the park managers to, instead of returning the receipts, the monies they collected, to the Land Water Conservation Fund, they were able to keep the money themselves. In keeping the money themselves, that provided all sorts of incentives for land managers to try to provide the kinds of additional facilities for which their customers would be willing to pay more. The long and the short is, for the national parks, the changes have been somewhat subtle. People are finding that they have to pay more than they did. They're paying not $5 as they had in years past, but up to $20 to get into the parks. But by and large, the program's been unopposed in the parks, and it looks like the program may be permanently authorized for the national parks. With the other land management agencies, the story's been entirely different. The fees that have been collected for the Forest Service and the Bureau of Land Management have resulted in very limited additional revenues. And the General Accounting Office, which is the government's own auditors, have found that fully 50 cents out of every dollar that the Forest Service collects has been spent on overhead administrative costs, cost of collections, cost of enforcement. The program's not been very successful. The agencies are trying as best as they can to put a happy face on this. They're tweaking the program. They're lobbying Congress on an almost daily basis. And right now there's a bunch of stuff happening legislatively.
Well, let's talk a little bit about some of the things that you've been doing over the last few years regarding this. I recall, was it already in 99 or perhaps even 98 that you were involved in some national days of protest regarding the fees?
Yeah, my role in all this is I was the person who stumbled across the issue, and I have worked since 1997 in getting this issue out in front of the American people, and I have to admit I've been reasonably successful in doing so. Some of the tools that we've used were, in fact, three national days of actions that I organized with help from other people. And I need to say that though I was the first who fell into this issue, today there are 260 organizations that have signed on in opposition to this program. There have been four states, including my own state of Oregon, that have passed resolutions opposing it. Other states include California, Colorado, and New Hampshire. These days of actions, each of them involved at a minimum 30 different locations in at a minimum 10 different states on the same day we would protest. And it was, in the earliest days, extraordinarily effective in generating media attention. The last one we did was 2 years ago, and that was after 9/11. And I have to tell you, it was the biggest one we did. It was the best one we did. And it was the one that got almost no media attention. Since 9/11, since the Patriot Act, since things have materially changed in this country, this form of public expression does not generate news media anymore. And so we have been looking at other strategies for being effective in countering this program.
Mm-hmm. Scott, do you feel like taking a call?
Sure.
Okay, hold on. Caller, are you on the air?
Yes. Uh-huh. I had a couple of questions for Scott.
Go ahead.
First of all, I was wondering about the Penn National Parks, which you mentioned a little while ago. I have noticed, I go to quite a few national parks, and I have noticed a definite change in the parks than they used to be, these rustic lodges that were run by the Park Service, and you felt like you were going into a nice, really remote places. And I have just noticed a tremendous change for commercialism. I mean, you have these companies that are running them, and you have cafeterias, and it's just you have reservations for dinner some places, and it's just sort of spoiling the parks. And I was wondering, how does that tie in with this recreation fee issue? And if you pay, say, $20 to go into a park, do you have to still pay to take certain trails and things like that?
Yes. The question you ask is the perfect question to ask.
I also have another question,
well,
too.
Let me first start with the question you asked, because it was a great one. The way we have been framing this issue since 1997 is we speak of the recreation industry's efforts to commercialize, privatize, and motorize recreational opportunities on America's public lands. We speak of the corporate takeover of nature and the Disneyfication of the wild. With regard to the national parks, there was legislation passed in 1998 that made it very easy for a handful of enormous concessionaires to gain monopoly control of the concessions in the national parks. Each of those concessionaires is a member of the American Recreation Coalition. Companies like Delaware North, which is the biggest of them, is on ARC's Recreation Roundtable. What's basically happening is the parks are changing in all of the ways we foresaw. The commercialization to which you refer is the threat that we are fighting continually. The parks used to be very democratic. They used to be an expression of what was best in America. They were one place where everyone was equal. Now they're becoming, compared to Disneyland, that's the kind of comparison the park managers speak of. As I mentioned at the beginning of this program, the Disney Company is directly involved in a very large way in promoting this program, and the park managers are literally trying to manage the parks as if they were Disneyland.
That's terrible.
Mm-hmm.
That's not what you want in a national park. It's bad enough in Disneyland. So you think that they're going to just get more and more that way?
Absolutely. As I said, the fact that the land managers can keep the money provides the perverse incentive to do everything that you and I perhaps would find inappropriate. And one of those things, and I did not mention this, is crucial to mention, is the overwhelming driving force behind the American Recreation Coalition is they are first and foremost a lobby group for the recreation vehicle industry, for the motorhome industry. And you may have noticed in recent years how the national parks are moving away from providing primitive, semi-primitive style camping for tent campers and are upgrading their parks to provide for the biggest motorhomes, to provide hookups, to really make it easy for the motorhome crowd. And you did mention those reservation systems. And the reservation systems are a further part of the American Recreation Coalition's efforts to create a commodity. When you can book it, it's a commodity.
Caller, did you have a follow-up?
Yeah, I just wanted to ask a question about not paying the recreation fees, because I was up at a I've been at a couple of national forests where they have these rec fees, and I one time paid, and then I decided, heck, I'm not going to pay. I have a rental car. They're never going to find me, so I didn't pay. But I just wanted to know, what generally can they do to you if you don't pay?
Another excellent question.
Thanks, caller.
There is no one right answer, because in this being a demonstration program, Congress did not allow the agencies to promulgate any new regulations to enforce the program. In fact, Congress specifically prohibited new regulations. So every agency is using what they had on their books as best they can. The maximum fine that Congress did permit is a $100 fine. However, the Bureau of Land Management, which is a very big land manager out here in the West, has on its own, starting on April 6th of this year, increased the maximum penalty to $5,000, and they did that through a rulemaking. And just so you know, there is legislation before Congress today, and we'll have a hearing on March the 6th of this year.
May the 6th.
And the legislation comes from Ralph Regula, the same person who put the rider into the appropriation bill that made this whole thing possible. Ralph Regula's bill, if it's passed, will make the maximum fine for failing to pay a $5 entrance fee to a national, any public lands, make it punishable by a $5,000 fine and 6 months in prison.
Oh my God.
will allow the law enforcement officer to issue the ticket to the registered owner of a vehicle regardless of who was driving it. So if you're driving a vehicle, you better drive a rental car so the ticket goes to Hertz or Avis.
Sounds like the federal jails are going to be filled with rainbow people really soon.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Well, what's been happening with development on the non-park lands, Scott? I mean, that's perhaps a bigger concern.
That's becoming a major issue, Mike. Basically, you're seeing it happen at all sorts of levels. There were some changes that the Forest Service just did this season. They've implemented something called the Blueprint. And the Blueprint is an effort to charge fees in a more standardized manner. And so they're deciding to not charge fees where there is no benefits provided at all, and to charge fees where some simple amenities are provided. And those simple amenities can be as simple as interpretive signing at the trailhead to let you know that it's a fee demonstration site. So you're seeing a lot of these signs springing up that's supposedly an amenity worth paying for, and that's the least damaging and most benign. But then there are places, and an example that comes to my mind is Lake Como in Montana, which was an undeveloped lake that was basically used by people who drove in, dropped their canoes in the water, and had the kind of experience you would expect on a quiet, undeveloped lake. Yeah. Fee demo was brought in. There's a concessionaire running the place now. It is totally and completely dominated by the jet ski crowd. It brings in lots of money for the agency, brings in lots of money for the concessionaire. It's apparently enjoyed by those who jet ski, but there are no people there anymore with their canoes and kayaks.
Back to the parks, it's just fortuitous that we're having our interview with you this week, as it's also, I guess, National Park Week.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw that President Bush issued a proclamation to that effect. He did that a few years ago. I saw on your website, or maybe it was in an email, that you had made a comment about his proclamation then, mm-hmm. basically saying that it's a fraud.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering, are there specific things that you can speak about that have happened on the national parks in the last 3 years regarding funding? You already spoke about some of the unfavorable things that have happened over the years with our caller. But I'm wondering, what has happened to funding of the parks, independently of the recreation fees?
Right. Well, that's a tremendous issue. It's in the news almost every day these days. First of all, let me just mention that the Bush administration, when it first came into power, made a very big deal that they would be known as the people who funded the parks and improved our crown jewels and restored the luster to our crown jewels. They have been anything but. The budgets for the parks, and especially the money that's getting to the ground, is not beginning to keep up with the needs for the parks. You find the director of the National Park Service, Fran Minella, announcing that there's going to be park closures, there's going to be doing away with interpretive programs and everything. And then a scandal developed around that, because what happened was a bunch of retired park superintendents and other fairly high-level retirees discovered that all of this was being plotted in the background. The public was being misdirected. They were talking about making service-level adjustments in public, whereas what they were saying in private is they were going to be laying off people, shutting down parks, closing parks for 2 days a week. Very contentious. Another issue with the parks that you in New York would have seen very recently has to do with the issue around the Statue of Liberty and the use of a private foundation to raise money to do improvements in the Statue of Liberty and further protect it in these days of threats and fears of terrorism. Mm-hmm. That private foundation is now being investigated for their handling of this process. Another thing that is really, I think, very important is you might remember that Washington Mall not long ago had a special gala Pepsi Britney Spears presentation. The mall was closed to the public, and it was basically privatized for the day with fences installed around the park. And there was a concert for Britney. This is a kind of privatization that's taking place for the Park Service every day. Just to let your listeners know this, the National Park Service is within the Department of Interior, managed by the Department of Interior. And the head of the Department of Interior, Gail Norton, is a long-time free market advocate. She's worked for at least two different free market think tanks and a couple of anti-environmental law firms. The idea of using user fees to privatize the national parks is right up her alley. Her policy director for budget and policy is a woman by the name of Lynn Scarlett. Lynn Scarlett is still to this day listed as the executive director of another one of these free market think tanks called the Reason Foundation. And the director of the National Park Service itself, Fran Minella, is a long, long time promoter of public-private partnerships and involving corporate interests. And she happens to be a member of the American Recreation Coalition's National Recreation Lakes Coalition. So we have just the worst possible people in power in the Department of Interior and the Park Service, the worst possible.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say that this stuff sounds just exactly like what the comes out of these libertarian capitalist business think tanks like Cato and American Enterprise Institute and Heritage Foundation.
No, you're exactly right, but slightly different names. The leaders are, in fact, the Political Economy Research Center in Bozeman, Montana. That's the longest time advocate for user fees. And so you know, their executive director, Terry Anderson, was on President Bush's interior transition team. The other major think tank, not so major but very visible, is a thing called the Thoreau Institute in Oregon. Head is Randall O'Toole. And this is an organization that basically is advocating for having the land management agencies receive no federal funding and to live entirely upon the revenue streams they generate. PERC, the other one I mentioned, would just like to simply privatize and move into private ownership the public lands. Two slightly different versions of how to privatize the American commons.
Right. And a concept that these people have been working on, I believe, is something called the Charter Forest.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we can talk about that for a couple of minutes yet.
Charter Forest is another one of these pilot programs, another demonstration program. And we're seeing a couple of early examples of it. The idea is that these will be public lands owned by the public, but not supported by the public. They will be required to receive 100% of their revenues required for maintenance and management through user fees or sale of commodity products or natural resources. The first charter forest that exists in this country is the Valles Caldera in New Mexico. We purchased it from the private sector as a nation 3 or 4 years ago, but we purchased it in a special form of legislation or a special legislative bill that said that after a phase-in period, there would be no federal funding and that this place would have to become 100% self-financing. The only public access that has been available to this day has been handled through a private concessioner, and they sell hiking access, and they have a couple of different hikes. You can walk with an interpretive person. You cannot hike or walk on your own. The least expensive hike is the shortest hike. It's 2.5 miles, and it costs $45 per person.
Oh, my God.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know how that's been working out?
Well, it's been exceedingly controversial, and there's a tremendous pressure to provide additional public access to this.
Sure. But, I mean, are people actually paying that kind of money?
Absolutely. You have to understand, in America, we have some very wealthy people who actually love the idea of user fees. Understand, user fees are a very regressive form of taxation. It used to be that when we provided for our public lands out of tax dollars, Bill Gates paid more in actual dollars to maintain the public lands than any of us on the telephone today paid. But that wasn't necessarily bad because Bill Gates is the richest man in the world. Today, it costs exactly the same for Bill Gates to use the public lands as it costs for us. And if it costs $45 to take a walk, you can be assured that you will not be walking with riffraff. And there are a lot of people who think that's pretty cool.
Well, I think we're going to have to wrap it up pretty soon, Scott. You did produce a video a few years ago.
I did indeed.
And is that still available?
Limited copies are available and more can be made. It was called Selling Our Birthright. And it was available as both a 10-minute short and then a 30-minute presentation, more suitable for airing on public access television.
Mm-hmm.
Just curiously enough, that title, Selling Our Birthright, is in fact a name that the National Sierra Club has picked up on, and they have produced literature themselves in opposition to this program. And have been very good, in fact, in educating their members to the threats of the fee demonstration program, and have in their national policy adopted language saying that the fee demonstration program is not a benign effort to fund our public lands, but is the recreation industry's effort to commercialize, privatize, and motorize recreational opportunities. That's actually the official National Sierra Club's language.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And how can a person obtain a copy of this video?
I think the best way to do that is there is information on the Wild Wilderness website. The address for our website is www.wildwilderness.org. Contact information for me is on that website through email. And for those who don't have email, you can reach me at 541-385-5261, and I'll arrange for you to get a copy.
Great. Okay. Well, thank you very much, Scott.
Thanks, Scott, for
being on
the
show. Thank you both for having me on today.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, this has been, once again, the Vegan Rainbow Show here on WHRW in Binghamton, and we'll see you next time. Bye.